heard Helen, their daughter, who was sitting with us, said, "Yes, and I ain't been fond of tea to this day." Willard said, "Blackberry wine builds up the blood. Doctors don't know all this yet." Whatever you wanted in Willard and Ora Watson's day, you made for yourself. Your medicine, your food, your house, your clothing, your furniture, your bedspreads and rugs. If you wanted a toy, you made your own cornshuck doll. If you wanted music, you carved your own dulcimer. "I remember the year I got an orange for Christmas," Helen said. "I think that's all I got, but I was thrilled. Everything I'd ever had to eat was homemade, except that." Of course, hardly anybody in the mountains today lives the purposefully plain life Ora and Willard Watson have had together. But I went to see one family that is making a pretty good attempt at it. They are my own distant relatives, Cecil and Julie Gerganus. Cecil's father, Ransom, was my mother's favorite first cousin when they were growing up together in Onslow County. The adventurous one, my mother used to tell me, who was always leading the other children into and out of mischief. By the time I came along, Ransom had lived in New York City, known Thomas Wolfe and other literary figures, and led a spare-time writing life of his own. He was a romantic figure to me, and remains so in my memory. When I was only 8 or 9 years old, he treated me as an adult. It was Ransom who encouraged me to plan a career in journalism, and to prepare for it by studying history and English in school. If this advice had come from anybody else, I might have shrugged it off. Because it came from Ransom, I followed it. I knew his son Cecil lived in the mountains, and one day I drove over into the New River Valley to find him. The drive from Boone took me past neat farmsteads on the Big Hill Road and through miles of unspoiled countryside. I saw only one sign the whole distance, a hand-painted sign on a barn that read, "Fresh Mountain Apples." Cecil and Julie Gerganus, their son John Brenn, and their daughter Sally, live in a house in the woods with flowers blooming around it. The house looks old and traditional, but Cecil, a handsome man with a great black beard, told me he built it himself of white oak trees he cleared on the place and sawed into lumber. After graduating from college, he built houses and hired out as a carpenter. Now he's his own man, having remodeled an old cattle barn nearby into a cabinet shop. He also makes musical instruments and plays fiddle and banjo in a traditional group called the Laurel Creek String Band. Julie plays guitar with the band when she's not too busy with the children. They grow their own vegetables and split their own firewood and devise their own family entertainment. As we talked, it was clear to me that Cecil and Julie have intentionally chosen a simple life, close to nature, rich in music and reading and conversation with friends. I was impressed by their children, who are growing up to appreciate this way of living. If two college-educated Americans can start a family and reach a very nearly perfect harmony in the United States, it occurred to me, Cecil and Julie probably have done it. They have methodically turned their backs on everything that is facile and shallow and mass-produced and harmfully addictive about American life: smoking, drinking, drugs, television, the urban rush, the acquisitive instinct. I drove back along the lonely North Carolina mountain roads with the dark coming on, reflecting on this. The hunger for worldly success is what sends people into the commotion and flurry of the big city suburbs and puts them in neckties and cocktail dresses and keeps them in their offices and commuter trains and country clubs for the rest of their lives. I tried to think of something Cecil and Julie and their children are missing by deliberately living so far off the beaten path. But I couldn't think of anything. June, Ketchikan, Alaska. It was raining in Ketchikan. This is like saying it was hilly in San Francisco, or it was crowded in Tokyo, or it was romantic in Paris. It is always raining in Ketchikan. Seattle, which has a reputation as a rainy city, gets 38 inches of rain a year. Ketchikan gets 15 feet. June is the driest month in Ketchikan. It rained the whole time I was there. I didn't care. It wasn't the kind of downpour that drives you indoors to stare glumly out the window. Ketchikan's rain is what you'd call a soft drizzle or a hard mist. It's steady, but it's gentle. I wore an old oiled green jacket and a Norwegian fisherman's cap every day and hung them both in the hotel bathroom every night. By morning, they were almost, but not quite, dried out. The rain reminded me of everything I love about southeastern Alaska. The rainforest, the mountain lakes, the waterfalls, the fjords, and the glaciers. When more rain and snow comes down on a mountain in the winter than melts away in the summer, eventually you have yourself a glacier. Alaska has tens of thousands of them. When I was planning my perfect year in America, I knew I had to spend a month of it in Alaska. But Alaska is way too big a place in which to contemplate spending a mere month, 2,500 miles across. There used to be four time zones, Pacific, Yukon, Alaskan, and Aleutian, before the bureaucrats, playing God with the sun, reduced the four time zones to a mere two sometime in the 80s. If I wanted to explore only along the coast, well, the tidal coastline measures 47,000 miles. So I thought, well, I'll just poke around in southeastern, as Alaskans call the panhandle, which stretches down toward the lower 48 states, and see how far north I get. I got only as far north as Glacier Bay, revisiting a few favorite places along the way, but the beauty of this trip along the Inside Passage took my breath away, the effect it always has had on me, the effect it has on every visitor. I said to a Tlingit Indian woman one time that I thought she lived in the most dazzling place in America. "It's God's thumbprint," she said. And it is. I started in Ketchikan, which is only an hour and a half on Alaska Airlines from Seattle, but a world away. There's no place for a jet to land at Ketchikan. There's barely room enough for a town between the mountains and the sea, and no room at all for a runway. In the old days, the jets landed on Annette Island, and you caught a Grumman Goose amphibian to Ketchikan. The goose would set itself splashily down in the harbor, reverse its engines with a mighty roar, and taxi over to the Front Street boardwalk. You'd climb out, pick up your suitcase, walk across the street to the Gilmore Hotel or the Ingersoll, and you were there. Today they've taken some of the romance away, possibly because of goose obsolescence. The jets land at a new airport on an island just across the Tongass Narrows, and you get to town by short-haul ferry. It's still a wonderful town to get to. Right into the second half of this century, Ketchikan was a wild little burg, given to temporary employment in the canneries and shingle mills on the harbor, and temporary pleasures for the gillnetters, loggers, and miners in the bars, bordellos, and dance halls on Creek Street. Part of the town's charm is that it doesn't seem quite respectable yet. The old bawdy houses are jewelry stores, souvenir shops, and cafes now. All you get for your $2.50 at Dolly Arthur's famous establishment on Creek Street is a bordello museum tour. But it's easy to imagine the days of the Alaska Bone Dry Law, 2 years before national prohibition, when bootlegger skiffs slipped into the creek at high tide and unloaded their cargo through trapdoors right into the parlors of the fancy houses. The Alaskan word for the cargo entered the American language. It was hooch. Hooch is still available, but these days most of it is consumed in the form of Bloody Marys by the tourists who gush from the newly arrived cruise ships by the thousands every morning at breakfast time, and wander around looking for a warm place to get in out of the rain. Creek Street is ready for them. The bars open early, with vodka bottles at the ready and the ice already in the glasses. The shopkeepers stand by. The cruise passengers have their brunches and buy all the T-shirts, postcards, gold nuggets, Haida carvings, and usiks they can carry. An usik is a popular Alaskan souvenir, a long white bone, the awe-inspiring organ of a male walrus. It awakens a sincere compassion for female walruses. Then the ships sound their loud, mournful horn, signaling that they're preparing to get underway, and the passengers stream back to the dock. Creek Street empties out by mid-afternoon, and solitary strollers have the place to themselves. Not that you ever see the sun in rainy Ketchikan, but in June it doesn't set until 10:30 at night or so. It doesn't get really dark until nearly midnight. You have to remind yourself when to have your supper. Most nights I had mine in the solarium dining room of my hotel, the Cape Fox Lodge on the hill above town. A solarium sounds like a non sequitur in a place with no sun, I know, but the room was beautiful and the food was good, and I liked the sound of the rain on the roof. Many people in Ketchikan go home by climbing endless outdoor flights of rickety wooden stairs up to their houses in the hills. The Cape Fox makes it easy for its guests by giving them a scenic tramway ride from Creek Street right up into the lobby. The Cape Fox is the newest hotel in Ketchikan, and I suppose the nicest anywhere in southeastern Alaska. It took a day or two to get used to the luxury, but I managed it. On previous trips to Alaska, I've slept in one-room Forest Service cabins in the wilderness, in the kitchen of an Eskimo woman's house on an island in the Bering Strait, and often in a sleeping bag beside a campfire. And all these accommodations suited me just fine. This time I confess that I enjoyed coming home to a warm, dry room with an easy chair and a reading lamp. The hotel is owned by a native corporation, a monument in polished cedar to the prosperity of the local tribes. The public rooms are adorned with massive native carvings. The restrooms are marked Ha and Sha, which didn't take too much figuring out once I thought about it. A semicircle of five fine totems by a famous young carver named Lee Wallace stands outside the hotel's front door. There is space for a sixth, and I went down to Saxman, the native village a few miles south, to watch Lee Wallace working on it. Lee comes naturally by his ability with chisel and adze. His father, Bill, was a carver and one of the last 50 pure-blood Haida elders. Bill's father was John, known as Sadoots, chief carver of the Haida village of Haidaberg on Prince of Wales Island. Lee said that when he is really hard at work on a totem pole, he can finish 1 foot a week. He said his grandfather John could carve 1 foot a day. John's father Dwight was a carver, and Dwight's father was a carver too. So totem carving goes back five generations in the family. Lee said his young son Suits, Brown Bear, is already playing with the carving tools. I looked on for a while in silence as Lee Wallace worked. I knew better than to ask him the meaning of the totem he was carving. To know the meanings of totem poles, you have to know that Raven created the earth out of rocks and mud and stole the sun, the moon, and the stars from his grandfather to give to human beings. You have to know this and hundreds of other stories about eagle, wolf, bear, and frog, fog woman, tide woman, and thunderbird. Most Tlingits, Haidas, and Tsimshians don't fully understand the totem poles their grandfathers created. You had to be there at the time to hear the stories told at the big parties or potlatches that were held when the poles were erected. Some of the old totems told the stories of families and used figures that could never appear on another family's pole. Some totems served as a record of wealth, with potlatch rings counting the number of great feasts the family had given, with gifts for all the guests. When your family gave another potlatch, you didn't add another ring. You carved another pole with one more ring on it. Others served as mortuary poles. The ashes of a dead chief were placed inside in elaborately carved boxes. Still others were heraldic, serving the same purpose for a family that a coat of arms did in old Europe. You can see more totem poles around Ketchikan than anywhere else in the fabulous world of the Northwest Indians, and some of them are art of the very highest order. I huffed and puffed up the steep hill beside the falls of Ketchikan Creek until I reached the Totem Heritage Center, a handsome building where some very old, unrestored totems are protected from the elements. I had a little shock when I walked inside. The first thing I heard was the sound of my own voice. 25 years ago, I visited some of the empty native villages and filmed an on-the-road story about abandoned totem poles. They were playing this very story in an anteroom of the Totem Heritage Center to show visitors where the center's totems had come from. I sat down and watched it myself. The slender 35-year-old Charles Kuralt stood in a clearing and explained to the 59-year-old Charles Kuralt things about totem poles that he had forgotten. Very interesting. Some of the old poles were obviously the work of master carvers. Even neglected out there on the island, tilted and fallen and forgotten, victims of fungus and carpenter ants, the poles were magnificent, and one of them in particular. I walked into the main museum, and there it was, facing me head-on, the same majestic totem I had just seen on screen, the one I filmed, covered with moss, in the overgrown village of Old Kasan in 1970. When the people abandoned their island villages decades ago to find work in the canneries of the growing cities, the ancient totem poles stayed where they had been erected, staring out to sea. The people didn't realize they were leaving behind part of their identity. Now they can walk up a hill in Ketchikan to the Totem Heritage Center and find it again. I flew to Juneau. Imagine a state capital with no roads leading to it. And I spent the night at a hotel on the waterfront after arranging a trip for the next morning to Glacier Bay. I remembered Glacier Bay as one of the most spectacular places on Earth, and I wanted to go back there no matter what. I have a cigar box full of old baggage tags at home. Some directed my luggage to places that no longer exist. IDL for Idlewild, now John F. Kennedy Airport, New York. CTJ for Ciudad Trujillo, now Santo Domingo. LPV for Leopoldville, the Congo, now Kinshasa, Zaire. Some are souvenirs of long trips to small places. YDS for Desolation Sound. TVF for Thief River Falls. MSA for Muskrat Dam. I picked up a new one in Juneau, GST for Gustavus. I could live in Gustavus. If I did, though, it would be a little hard to explain to people where I lived. Gustavus is a stretch of woods and open fields along Icy Strait near the entrance to Glacier Bay, home to about 400 loners and rebels and seekers of peace and quiet. They live in widely spaced cabins in the woods. There's no town, because a town would mean elections and laws and taxes, and nobody wants the hassle. If Gustavus had a government, paved roads and streetlights would probably be next. Gustavus has no police, no bank, no hospital. It does have a gas station with ancient flying red horse pumps, but the gas station is open only 2 hours, and only on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. If you have a car full of gas, you have a choice of three destinations: the airport, the dock, and the Glacier Park Lodge. After breakfast one morning, I was looking through the books in the lodge gift shop when a man came up to me and said, "You want to see the glaciers from up top?" He said he recognized me from television. This was Steve Pierce, who had flown his Cessna 172 float plane over from Juneau for the day with his wife, Neela. The two of them, it turned out, were owners of the Waterfront Gallery, one of the best of the many art galleries in downtown Juneau. Steve is one of those Alaskans who's been everything at one stage or another: firefighter, paramedic, halibut fisherman, and bush pilot. I accepted his invitation to take a ride. A few minutes later, we were climbing away from Bartlett Cove above the Brady Ice Field, which spawns many of the glaciers that plunge down into the west side of Glacier Bay. The view in the bright sun was resplendent, a fantastic jumble of ice-capped granite mountains close at hand, towering above us to the north, the brilliant broad ice field stretching to the horizon below, and farther below, the rippled surface of Glacier Bay, reflecting bursts of sunlight back into our eyes like a thousand flashbulbs going off at once. My mistake was in leaving my sunglasses in my room. I had to squint to keep from being blinded up there. If I lived in Alaska, I would certainly learn to fly a float plane. All over Alaska, small planes are the preferred means of going grocery shopping, running errands, picking up the mail, and just getting out of the house for a while. The other choice, of course, would be a boat, a slower option for covering Alaska's immense watery distances, but an even better platform for seeing the natural world close up. One day I boarded the Captain Connor, an elegant old twin-screw launch operated by the Park Service, for a whale-watching trip into Icy Strait. We weren't underway 5 minutes before we had to steer around a sea otter lying on her back in a bed of kelp. All the sea otters I've ever seen in my life were lying on their backs, sometimes patiently dismantling a crab or abalone, and using their bellies as breakfast trays. They seemed to live their lives on their backs, feeding, nursing their young, watching the world go by. Now that human beings have left off murdering them for their fur, otters are all over the place, lying on their backs, living sweet lives. Salmon jumped around us and splashed back into the sea. They say the jumpers are all females loosening their eggs before going up the streams to spawn. For nearly an hour, I watched a bald eagle circling, diving, obviously spotting plenty of salmon, but failing to snag one. Eagles are powerful birds, but they're not always smart enough to pick on somebody their own size. Occasionally, they sink their talons into too big a fish, find they can't let go, and are pulled underwater and drowned. I've heard trawler crews tell about hauling big salmon with eagle corpses attached. Our skipper was Jay Flory, port captain of Glacier Bay, a former Coast Guardsman from the lower 48, who was assigned to Alaska and found a way to stay. His is usually an important but slightly tedious job ashore, keeping the Park Service boats fueled and working. So he was on a busman's holiday on the Captain Connor, wearing a big gap-toothed grin because he was out of the office for the day. He said this wheelhouse is the best office in the world. Captain Flory found us some humpback whales traveling north off Point Adolphus and fell in beside them, idling along at a respectful distance so as not to disturb them. I was trying to make photographs with a 500-millimeter lens, and Jay gave me a handy tip. Humpbacks almost invariably blow 4 times. You can count the spouts. 1, 2, 3, 4. Then they roll their big backs out of the water. Then, on cue, they sound, with their great tails pausing in the air a few seconds for the benefit of photographers. I got the hang of it and made some good pictures of whale tails. I left Glacier Bay after a few days and went back to Juneau. From any street corner in Juneau, you can look up into the wild mountains. My month was running out, and I yearned to soak up some more wildness before I had to leave. I called Butch Laughlin, who makes a living by flying yearning souls to beautiful places. It's not necessarily much of a living, Butch said, barely enough to make the payments on his new blue-and-white $120,000 Cessna. He said he and his wife would starve if it weren't for the body shop he runs in the winter. But it's flying that Butch loves, and in the summertime, he flies. I met him early in the morning at the pond, the floatplane canal that parallels the airport runway. Where do you want to go? He asked. I said, someplace lonely. We took off from the pond, flew south over the Gastineau Channel, and then turned west into the mountains. After a while, I could see a couple of mountain lakes down there, a small high one connected to a larger low one by a ribbon of waterfall. Butch put the plane over on its wing and aimed us for the large one. Lower Sweetheart Lake, he said. I've never seen anybody here. I've never talked to anybody who's ever been here. I bet not 5 people a year ever come here. We landed, taxied over to the outlet of the stream that was created by the waterfall, and tied the plane to a streamside tree. I stepped down on the pontoon and onto the shore, and stood there looking down the length of the lake. After the racket of the flight in, the silence of the place was overpowering. The surface of the lake was utterly still and utterly magnificent, a deep blue jewel in a setting of steep green woods. From where I stood, everything I could see was as serene and virginal as on the day of creation. I didn't want to leave Southeast Alaska. It's God's thumbprint. Alaskans refer to everywhere else as outside. The day came when I had to go back outside where I'd come from. On the plane to Seattle, I sat next to a Tlingit lawyer, Leroy Wilder, who had been out on the islands working on some land case. He talked about his youth and upbringing in Southeast, and I talked about my month in his native country. He was wearing a tie with a subtle totem design. When I noticed it and told him I admired it, he took it off and gave it to me. "To remember us by," he said. "I still have your tie, Mr. Wilder. I remember." July, Ely, Minnesota. A birch tree grows on the shore of Moose Lake. A canoe lies on the bank beside it. From that birch tree, you could paddle the canoe up to the end of Moose Lake and camp overnight, and put the canoe in another lake the next morning. You could cross that lake and camp for the night, and paddle across another lake on the third day. You could keep this up, visiting a different lake every day, for 100 years. And you still wouldn't get to all the lakes. Henry David Thoreau wrote, "A lake is the landscape's most beautiful and expressive feature. It is Earth's eye." I sat on a rock beside the birch tree, looking into the eye of the Earth. I was watching the sun go down on Moose Lake and thinking about the universe of green forest and blue water I had come to in a day's drive north from Minneapolis-St. Paul. Loons called to each other out on the lake. Thunder rumbled away to the north in Canada. I stayed there until the night came on. This was not the Moose Lake down there south of Kettle River, and not the Moose Lake west of Nashwauk, and not the Moose Lake that the Big Fork River flows out of. God knows how many Moose Lakes there are in Minnesota. This was that other Moose Lake, the one east of Ely, where the roads run out and the boundary waters begin. The Boundary Waters canoe area is 1 million acres of wilderness, with no roads, no buildings, no sign that human beings have ever been there, except for Indian pictographs on some of the rocks, and footprints on some of the portages, and signs of old campfires on some of the islands. Motors are barred. No outboard motors, no airplanes, no generators compete with nature's sounds. No cans or bottles are permitted. It is unlawful to cut down a tree, or even to cut off a bough or chip away bark. Groups of more than 10 canoeists must split up and go in different directions. If it's absolute solitude you want, you have only to paddle far enough. If the vast and glaciated U.S. wilderness isn't big enough for you, a Canadian wilderness of equal size awaits across the border. Without a topographic map and a compass, there's no way to tell which country you're in anyway. In 2 or 3 days of paddling and portaging, you can be reasonably assured of reaching the beautiful lake of your fondest dreams, where you can set up camp for a week or two without hearing another human voice. I had not come to Moose Lake to embark on an arduous wilderness trip, not this time. I've done it in years gone by, and I remember how long those uphill portages can be with a canoe and a backpack to carry. I thought it would be enough to wait until July when the black fly season is over, go as far north in Minnesota as I could, find a cabin on the last point of land where cabins are permitted, and just look at the wilderness and think about it. The cabin came close to qualifying as a log mansion. I was planning to stay in a sparse outfitter's camp, but Linda Fryer, the energetic woman who runs the Ely Chamber of Commerce, called Chet and Nancy Neasel, friends she'd heard were planning to be away, and next thing I knew, I was ensconced in the Neasel's house, or rather, in part of it. I occupied the spacious kitchen, a bedroom facing the lake, and the more extravagant of the bathrooms, without needing to venture into the rest of the dwelling, which was filled with the furniture and collections of an obviously well-lived life. I never met the Neasels, but I feel I know them. Sleeping in somebody's bed will do that to you. The birch tree and the canoe belonged to the Neasels, and the shoreline where I sat to watch the sunset that first night, and most of the nights that followed. How I envy them. Any time they want, they can drive 20 miles out of Ely, nearly to the end of the Fernberg Trail, turn left on the road toward Moose Lake, pass through groves of pine and stands of aspen, ash, and maple for a mile or two, bump along a few hundred yards of fire trail, and pull into the dirt driveway of their own utopia. It was my good fortune that the owners were away. If it were my house, I think I'd never leave. Minnesotans are different from the rest of us, as I was reminded on the trip into Ely. Minnesotans don't smoke. The Minneapolis airport was the first in the nation to ban smoking, even in the bars. Minnesotans recycle. There are separate containers at the highway rest stops for cans, bottles, and plastic. Minnesotans return the grocery cart to the store. Minnesotans do not consume butterfat. At the supermarket in Virginia, Minnesota, where I stopped for groceries, they had abundant gallons of skim milk, 1% milk, 2% milk, and some kind of healthy milk substitute. I had to look a long time to find real milk on a side shelf. Minnesotans bike with their helmets on. Minnesotans fasten their seat belts. Minnesotans hold the door for you. Minnesota men don't leave the toilet seat up. Minnesotans do not blow their horns behind you when the light turns green. They wait for you to notice. Minnesotans are nicer than other people. The farther away from the big cities you go, the nicer they are. Ely is about as far away as you can get. Ely is a town full of good people. I know all towns are. But Ely has always seemed to me especially rich in neighborliness and good nature and the salt of the earth virtues. It's hard to be a stranger there. If your name is Charles, everybody in Ely calls you Chuck. I don't mean that there is anything bland or insipid about Ely. The town wasn't founded by canoe paddlers who came for the beauty. It was founded by miners who came for the iron. They were tough Swedes and Finns and Norwegians, durable Irishmen and muscular Slavs. The rough mining camp they staked out late in the last century was an ugly little place on the edge of a scenic paradise. I went to see Mike Hillman, the 42-year-old son and grandson and great-grandson of miners, in his house beside the old Pioneer Mine on the north edge of town. Mike wrote a good short book, A History of the Vermilion Range. Mike's wife Julie gave us coffee and blueberry pie made with berries they'd picked the afternoon before in a nice berry patch only 3 portages from the house, as she said. And Iron Mike and I talked the afternoon away. Laconic phrases came out of Mike Hillman in a natural North Country poetry. "I'm the keeper of this ghost mine right here on Miner's Lake," he said. "This was the richest square mile of iron in the world. They took 82 million tons of ore from the Pioneer and the other mines in Ely. Between 1889 and 1967, 152 miners died in mudslides and cave-ins. When there was a cave-in, the whistle blew for 10 minutes. They called it the Screamer. I remember that whistle blowing, wondering who was in the cave-in, wondering if it was my dad. It never was. I met Mike's father later. They call him Checker, because that was his job in the mine. Mike said my grandfather hugged and kissed his children every day before he went to work, and I realized it was because he didn't know for sure whether he'd come home. More than 150 of them didn't come home, and when I got to looking into it, I found that for every death by cave-in, there were 5 deaths by suicide. I asked my dad about it. He said, you have to realize, they came across an ocean with big dreams, and ended up in a raw town in the North Woods with no prospects except to be given 5 candles every morning to wear in their hats and then go down into that black hole day after day. The disappointment was too great for some of them. Mike then digressed, all good storytellers digress, to tell me, offhand and by the way, one of the most affecting small-town stories I've ever heard. It is a tale of patriotism. The most popular man in Ely was Leonard Zupančič, the Slovenian owner of Zup's Food Store. Zup was a regular in the poker game in the basement at Vertine's, a leading citizen, a friend to all, and a benefactor of the community. He was also an old-fashioned patriot who loved Ely's 4th of July celebration. If the collection for the fireworks fell a little short, the town could always count on Zup to kick in $2,000 or $3,000 to guarantee a great fireworks show. Nobody enjoyed the fireworks as much as Leonard Zupančič himself. Last year, with the 4th of July approaching, Zup failed to show up for the poker game. His friends knew something was terribly wrong. They went around to his house and found him dead. Zup's death was a blow to Ely. Everybody wanted to give him a suitable memorial. The people in charge of the fireworks thought of one. On the night of the 4th of July, without letting it be known, they loaded Zup's ashes into a skyrocket. After all the other fireworks, the pinwheels and serpents and candle bombs had been discharged, there was a respectful pause. Then one last skyrocket rose into the dark sky, higher than all the others. Up it went, higher and higher, until it exploded with a great flash, the moment Zup always loved so much. Everybody cheered, and there in the darkness, floating down on his town, came Zup. I told Mike my patriot grandfather, Leo Kuralt, the son of an immigrant from Slovenia, would have loved to have gone that way himself, if anybody had thought of it. In Mike Hillman, I figured I'd stumbled upon the soul of Ely, Minnesota. He is a tenacious and able man of the North. In the spirit of his forebears, he can do anything he sets his mind to do, even if it's something he's never done before. He said, for a while there, I was the head howler at the Wolf Center. Ely has wolves in the neighborhood, dozens of roving packs of them, at least 10 times as many wolves as the rest of the lower 48 states combined. In the middle of my first night on Moose Lake, I heard them howling from the peninsula across the water. High two-note wails sliding into yips in the extreme upper register. The sound echoed in my dreams that night. I could understand the thrill and dread that sound has inspired in human beings down the centuries. The International Wolf Center in Ely attracts wolf biologists from all over the world intent on studying the wolves, and tourists who'd like to go out at night and hear them howl. So Iron Mike Hillman volunteered to become Leatherlungs Hillman and howl up some wolves for the tourists. "Howling is tough business," he said. "I'm not kidding you. I practiced at home and got to be a pretty good howler." I introduced myself to the people. "Hello, I'm the head howler," and that impressed them. I'd drive a van full of people out to where I thought the wolves might be and let her rip. Sometimes I was lucky and the wolves would howl back and the people would think I was just wonderful. Other times I'd just get hoarse. "Don't let him fool you," Julie Hillman said. "If he couldn't get a response from the wolves, he'd go out behind a house that had sled dogs." One night, after supper back at the cabin, I was sitting in the dark at my usual place by the birch tree on the shore, listening to the loons on the lake. A big orange moon was rising. Suddenly, a loud wail arose across the water that sent a chill down my spine. The wolves were back, this time very close at hand on the opposite shore. I launched the canoe as quietly as I could and paddled toward the sound. I've never seen a timber wolf in nature. I thought it would be just right to see one on a wilderness shore under a full moon. I stopped in the water a little way from where I thought the last howls had come and waited. The only sound was the water lapping at the gunwales of the canoe. The moon rose higher. All the folklore of wolves came back to me as I sat there, the ancient evocations of the wolf at the door, the big bad wolf, nemesis of the three little pigs who huffed and puffed and blew their house down, the wolf who ate Little Red Riding Hood. "My, what big teeth you have, Grandma." The drawings in old adventure books of wolves surrounding hapless winter travelers, baring their fangs and moving in for the kill. Pure invention, they tell you at the Wolf Center. Wolves have devoured little pigs, no doubt, but in all the authentic history of North America, there is no record of a wolf attacking a human being. Fair enough, and I certainly had no intention of attacking a wolf. I just wanted to see one. I waited an hour. I heard no sound except the loons and saw no movement. I finally tried a howl of my own to see if anything would happen. Nothing did. I remembered that wolves travel far and fast. In an hour, the pack could easily be 20 or 30 miles away. I paddled back to the cabin, hauled the canoe up on the bank, and went into bed. Just as my head hit the pillow, the wolves set up an unearthly howl from nearby, just across the lake, right where I had been. 10 years ago in Ely, somebody left a dead wolf on the steps of the Forest Service building. This was Jim Brandenburg talking about the long war human beings have waged against wolves. He is a great nature photographer. His experiences with wolves in Minnesota and on Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic have resulted in haunting books like the bestseller Brother Wolf. "Now wolves are having their day," he said. "Really, it's gone too far. Wolves are being overstudied by the experts with radio collars and airplanes, and they're becoming overloved by the public." I got the impression he expects to go downtown one day and find wolf aprons and wolf keyrings for sale in the stores. "They're not exactly rare," he exclaimed. "There are 2,000 wolves in Minnesota." After all his years among wolves, there was a kind of weary sadness about Jim Brandenburg. The biologists have come along and taken his animals away from him, and he seems resentful but resigned. He's preparing to move on to another subject, perhaps, I'd guess, even to another place. He's the one person I met who seemed restless in Ely. "My parents weren't born here, and I wasn't," Jim remarked. "So to a lot of people in Ely, I'll always be a packsacker." Packsacker? I tried the expression on Mike Hillman the next time I saw him. "Outsider," he said. "Being at the end of the road, we've always had packsackers, all kinds. In the old days, the mob in Chicago used to send guys up here to hide out until the heat was off. My dad used to take them fishing. People asked him, 'Aren't you afraid of these guys?' He said, 'I'm the safest one in the boat. I'm the only one who knows how to get home.'" To tell you the truth, Mike said, we're all packsackers. The Ojibwe would like to think they've been here forever, but they came from somewhere else. The French trappers and the British traders were packsackers, and so are we. It's okay to be a packsacker. Bob Carey, Jackpine Bob to the readers of his stories in the Ely Echo, is a square-jawed outdoorsman of the old school. In the Ojibwe language, Chippewa, some people still say, Bob Carey is Akwenzi, old man. He spent 2 years learning Ojibwe on the Vermilion Reservation and at the community college in Ely, where it's still taught. Bob said when an Ojibwe kills a deer, he kneels beside it and says, I'm sorry, old buck, I didn't kill you because I hate you, but because you give me meat and clothing and moccasins. I've started doing the same thing, Bob said. I think everybody ought to. Most Ojibwe hunters put tobacco in the fork of a tree before starting the hunt, not to help them get a deer, but in thanks for the opportunity. I asked Bob about the Indian casinos that are springing up everywhere. Well, he said, I'll never get used to seeing a guy I met on a trap line wearing a tuxedo and dealing blackjack, but life changes, doesn't it? A lot of the traditions still go on, though, ricing at the end of summer, for example. Net Lake is practically all wild rice, and it's still harvested. Outside the reservation, anybody can rice. I get mine right over here at Basswood. When the Indians are through ricing, they take two handfuls and raise their hands and let it fall through their fingers, an offering to the spirit. The Ojibwe have a more profound idea than we do of what life is all about. At the same time, they accept misfortune better than we do. If you misplace your knife at your campsite, you'll curse. The Ojibwe will laugh, because the knife was moved by the Memegwishi, the little people, the tricksters who live in the spirit lakes. If you turn your back on the fire and your coffee pot falls over, you have nobody to blame but yourself. The Ojibwe laugh and say, there go the little people again. Bob said, I think this ability to blame the spirits and not one another is one of the things that helped families living so closely crowded together get through the hard winters without falling out. I half believe in the spirits myself. If you're camped in the woods and stay very quiet, you can hear the little people laughing in the tops of the trees. I smiled and said, sounds to me like Jackpine Bob is going native. It wouldn't be the worst thing that could happen, Bob said. The Ojibwe are good people and very honest. They say that when you die, you have to carry everything you've ever stolen on your back through eternity. A buddy of mine heard that and said, damn, I better get me a pickup truck before I die. The Ojibwe are the best known of the canoe Indians, but they were not the first. They migrated into the northern lake country from the east at a time when the Sioux were the people of the forest. The two tribes fought over these lakes for 100 years. Ojibwe war parties, armed with rifles obtained from the French, finally pushed the Sioux west into the plains, which is how it happened that Hiawatha, the Ojibwe, happened to be in Minnesota to inspire Longfellow's poem, and Sitting Bull, the Sioux, happened to be in Montana to take Custer's scalp. Mike and Julie Hillman aim their canoe into the wilderness every chance they get. They know what they're doing out there. We had a long supper over at Snowbank Lodge one night, and I asked their advice. Julie said, we start planning about a week ahead of time. For this last trip, we bought 20 pounds of family steak at Zupp's and had them cut it up for beef jerky. We have our own dehydrator, and we make our own jerky. The number one rule is, do not take an ice cooler. We dehydrate our own fruit, apples, pears, peaches. All the drinks we take have NutraSweet in them. That's because the weight in food is the sugar weight. So we take Crystal Light instead of Kool-Aid, which weighs more. We really try to save ounces. We take wheat crackers, hard candy, coffee. We've learned to like powdered milk. We drink the water in the lakes, Mike said. They say don't drink the water. If the water from these lakes ever makes me sick, I'll know it's time to go somewhere else. Julie is my wife and lover at home, but in the woods she's my partner, which is a different thing. It's not a deeper relationship necessarily, but a different one. It's exciting to get up early and go. We don't travel hard, we just travel steady. We carry only what we need. These portages are killers. It's hard enough carrying what you need. You want to leave everything else at home. That night on Snowbank Lake, I felt at peace and at home, but I realized I was just a packsacker. Ely should always belong to people like Jack Pine Bob Carey and Iron Mike Hillman, who realize that lakes are the eyes of the earth, people who know enough to thank the Great Spirit for the rice harvest and to tread lightly on the portages. August, Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. This is one of the sweetest moments of life, the moment after you have shut down the engine of a sailboat. The sudden silence always comes as a sweet surprise. You let the bow fall off the wind, feel the sails fill, feel the boat heel gently for the instant it takes the craft to recognize its new and mysterious power, and then feel it surge forward, lines taut, bow rising, sails pulling, gathering momentum now, doing its business, in control, on course. Herb Smith shut down the engine of Appledore 5 off Spruce Point and aimed her for Ram Island on a starboard reach. I found a place to sit on the windward side of the schooner so I could watch the white houses in the hills above Booth Bay Harbor sliding away behind us and the sparse scattering of islands growing closer up ahead. Beyond those islands, there was nothing but the open Atlantic. I knew we were going to turn around and come back to Fisherman's Wharf before the sun went down, but it was exciting to think that for the present, we were flying along toward Gibraltar. After making adjustments to the sails, Doris Smith, Herb's wife, sat down on the cabin trunk to talk to me. "All our boats have been Appledores," she said. "It's the name of the small island off Kittery where I grew up. Herb and I built the first Appledore together and were married on it. We forgot to look at the tide tables. The tide went out and left the boat aground and tilting over with all the wedding guests about to slide off the deck. So we had to wait to get married until she leveled out on the incoming tide." We sailed past thousands of lobster buoys in the outer harbor, tidally aligned like rows of corn for easy harvest. We glided through a deep, narrow passage between Fisherman's Island and Ram Island. I admired the Ram Island lighthouse, and even more the abandoned keeper's dwelling, with an outhouse on the point which must have afforded the prettiest east-west view of any outhouse in New England. Doris said, "We built Appledore 2 at Gamage's Shipyard in South Bristol. That was our first round-the-world boat. We sold it when we came home. We built Appledore 3 in our backyard in New Hampshire. We started a dairy farm, but we found we couldn't make a living, so we built another boat. This was the other side of Dixville Notch. That boat made quite a sensation. When we said we were going to build a boat, the farmers thought we meant a rowboat to put in the lake up there. Appledore 3 was really a great cruising boat. We made our second round-the-world trip in her." I suffered a pang of envy. I learned to sail when I was still young enough to cross an ocean, and promised myself I'd do that someday at the helm of my own boat. But promises postponed have a way of getting broken. Now I was too old and my ability too rusty, and that particular dream, like so many others, was on the shelf for good. So it stung a little to be aboard a 64-foot topsail schooner with a still young couple who had sailed across all the oceans and around the great capes, and not once, but twice, and had taken their children along for good measure. The sun settled on the horizon, growing larger and softer in the late-day mist, reddening the gaff-rigged sails of Appledore as she headed obediently for her dock. We tied up quietly in the half-light of evening, with the lights coming on in town. I said my goodbyes to the Smiths and walked round to my room on the other side of the harbor. I felt elated to be back in Booth Bay Harbor with the whole month of August ahead of me. Excited me so that I could hardly get to sleep that night. I lay there imagining all the ways I could see again the coves and points.